I'm Tim O'Malley. I'm a detective. The story I'm going to tell you happened in October 1986 in Woodmire Lake, a small town in the Midwest. The residents of Woodmire Lake call this month Bloody October. The cases I covered that month of October were cold, calculating, ruthless murders. What makes this story so strange is that all of the murders and deaths happened on October 15th. What makes this story even stranger is that most of the murders and deaths happened to the Kent brothers and their families. The Kents had lived in Woodmire Lake for the past 70 years. Then, suddenly, all of the Kents were dead. All that is, except one member of the family.
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast. I am your host, Jason Bishop. Today is going to be a night to dismember. I don't know if you want to remember, but we'll dismember this movie. With me today, as always, is Sam Stepanenko. Sam Stepanenko.
So nice you had to say it twice. It's me.
Finally. Oh my gosh. And Trish Coughlin.
Hey, everybody.
And Jeff Omega.
Oh, hello. You know, I was going to try to remember some sort of quote from this movie because there's so many of them. Actually, too many to remember. But it's obscure enough that you can't find any of them written down anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. This week we're doing women in horror, and we're going to be talking about Doris Wishman, who was the queen of sexploitation and probably the most prolific female director in the post-Sound Age. And maybe still, she directed right up until her death, although after this movie, she took a long pause because I think it broke the bank of $2.50. This movie has a much richer backstory than the movie itself. This movie is terrible and should be seen by nobody.
Or it's terrible and should be seen with a room full of people.
Yes.
Ooh,
yes.
That's a good alternative.
Do it with friends so you can tear it apart. Dismember it, if you will.
Yeah, we do regret not watching this all together because this was probably worse than Hard Rock Zombies, and it would have been a lot of fun to watch it with you guys all together.
Yeah. Well, remember when you said we were going to do this one, and I was like, yeah, it had a Hard Rock Zombies feel to it. I think this is, when you say it must be watched with other people, here's the disclaimer and the emergency warning. If you've been quarantined and you're alone and you can't go out and there aren't other people around, don't watch this movie. Like, no, your stir craziness, it will make it worse.
Especially if you watch it twice.
Oh,
like we
did. Once. I didn't have the energy.
Basically, there's two completely different versions of this movie, one of which only resurfaced in 2018.
Yes, which would have been actually the original cut. Now, what happened was, depending on who you talk to, the original film, once it was shot, the footage was lost. Either it was a disgruntled employee, somebody at the lab processing the film fucked up, or a fire, all of which I've heard that are possibilities, and only Doris knows for sure, and she is not telling, at least didn't leave it in a note from the grave. But
well, there's a fourth theory as well. Is that she actually pulled a bunch of the footage and recut it because Samantha Fox paid her $2,000 to have featured in the film.
That was my theory as well, is like, okay, if somebody's going to pay you $2,000 to be the star of your film, you look at the film. I doubt it cost $2,000. Maybe, I'm not sure what the cost of film was. Film isn't exactly cheap
And a smoke machine.
And a smoke machine that for
just, oh, no.
They must have had it for a day. We're going to use it as much as possible. Completely. Inside, outside, it doesn't matter if it makes sense.
Why the fuck is there smoke on the stairs?
I don't know.
You know, it's a cinematic. It's you know, it's a creative choice.
Yeah.
In a movie full of creative choices.
It made me think of, you know how like some movies, they kind of use like kind of the smoke to show like it's a ghost or an otherworldly entity kind of creeping along the floor and around. And I've seen that before. And this whole movie, I kept thinking, wow. And every time I've seen that in cinema, I never once thought, hey, this is how you avoid evil, a fan. And I think this is probably something that should be put in a movie now since I've watched this. You want, not today, devil. I've got a handheld fan.
I would say that's a... Doris Wishman is kind of like a cross between Ed Wood and Herschel Gordon Lewis.
I would say that was accurate. I mean, she only made this one horror movie, but it did kind of had a blood feast vibe to it. It can get pretty gory at times, and, you know, them stabbing their chickens and stuff, but yeah. Or whatever meats they found at the produce market. Although,
yeah, there's this, the odd thing.
There's a scene. I think it was in the original cut. The Samantha Fox cut, where they're all sitting and having dinner, and it's just sandwich meat on a plate.
Yeah,
yes.
I'm like, but they're eating with their fingers.
Yeah,
it's just sandwich meat and slices of cheese. Like,
yeah,
like American sliced cheese.
And Dad's like, use a fork.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Yeah, that's a good old white trash charcuterie.
Yeah. So
that was really good.
So what happened with the footage that she had available to her, and she was just learning editing at the time, clearly. When you watch this movie, she was trying
to... Did she
to...
really learn
no,
it?
I don't know if she did.
No, she actually was not credited as the editor, but basically she got her start in the 50s where she taught herself everything.
Oh,
but
yeah,
at this point, she started movies for like 20 years.
Yeah, yeah, no, she'd been in it a while. I mean, she was born in 1919, so she started fairly late and got into the sexploitation and eventually actually directed her own pornography. And with the success of Halloween, she wanted to do a horror movie, get in there nice and early and do something like Halloween. This movie was shot in 1977. It took 4 years to get it together and still didn't see the light of day until 1983 and might not have even got a proper release until 88 with the video market. So it took a while. It took a long, long while for anybody to see any version of this movie. Now, I don't know why she thought the footage was lost when her cinematographer, or the guy holding the camera in this case, had a videotape
version
being
generous,
of it. Yeah, yeah. That's why I said the guy holding the camera, the human tripod.
Yeah.
It's so strange. Like, I legitimately feel like there's... I mean, like Sam said, maybe she was hard up for cash, took the $2,000, told everybody that the... film was lost and raised funds to finish it, because before this lost version of the movie was found, people were skeptical that there even was an original version. People thought that she made it up to garner sympathy to fund a bad movie, but obviously there was an original version.
I think she did get some funding from somewhere else and probably was contractually obligated to finish it, but she ducked out of the industry for quite a while after this movie, and she worked in a porn store selling dildos and stuff. She had some adult
That's
store
so crazy.
Yeah, and then like, she came back.
Nothing wrong with selling dildos.
No, somebody's got to. and clearly exactly. from the stuff she was doing, she was familiar with the material anyway. You want somebody who's going to know about the dildo if it's going to sell it to you. I'm just saying.
Okay, look, if you're putting it on your naughty bits, you want to know that you're getting something quality. That's all I'm saying.
That's right. She would return back to filmmaking in the early 2000s, and her final film was released after her death. But clearly she had fans in the B-movie industry. There were quite a few cameos in it, including guys like John Waters that were in that last movie. Despite the fact that she was still pulling the same tricks of using stock footage from an older movie and just with some new shots. That was her kind of jam. Let's just like, we've got this. We can use it. We haven't used it all up yet.
Yeah.
From what I was reading, it seems that John Waters was like a massive fan of Doris Wishman. And watching these movies and then reading about some of the other movies she made, I can definitely see why John was a fan. She made a bunch of movies with this woman named Chesty Morgan, who I just had massively, massively huge breasts that are like 70 inches long, which is just ridiculous. And she made a movie, a detective movie, where Chesty Morgan was a detective who used her breasts to smother evildoers.
Oh, I've heard of this one. But when describing breasts, don't go long.
No, you know what? If you look at them, they are long.
They were as long as they were wide.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, if you're talking breasts, let's just talk circumference. That's what we're going for. Because like length is just going to happen anyway. And we don't want to talk about that. But you know, when you're talking about like this exploitation stuff with her and like this movie, I watched the lost version and I can kind of see it's a weird, strange thing where I think I can see how her eye from sexploitation went into this, possibly because you see there's some interesting shots and she does a lot with there's some visuals that she puts in there. So it's like she puts the visuals well above the narrative. And I think that's sort of very telling in like what she used to with the sexploitation genre is it's like image over narrative. So it kind of bled into this. And I think that's why there's such a trouble trying to find a plot thread.
You were lucky because this one actually had some sort of narrative.
It's like Citizen Kane compared to the other one.
Yes.
Yeah. Nice. No, this one, because I watched the original cut or the release cut, and then I watched the lost one afterwards to put it back into context. So that movie is just a puzzle. Like the movie itself, regardless of what version you watch, was shot silently and then dubbed over badly. Now,
yes,
they completely cut out their lead actress for the release cut in favor of Samantha Fox. So they had to create a new narrative for it, a really loose one that the character of Vicky had been coming home from being in a mental institution. And when I think she was tied to the deaths at the beginning, since she turns back up at home, more deaths are happening. And loosely, she's the prime suspect, but it winds up being her sister, who's actually her mother in the lost version.
No, she's Vicky. She's the daughter.
No, that's I got it right. Her sister Mary in the original cut is the mom in the lost cut.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's actually almost like two separate movies in the lost version. You've got that first 45 and it's about mom and being knocked up and killing her family. And then Vicky at 16, 17, growing up with her foster parents and then going all loopy because everybody's making fun of her, calling her crazy. And she just leans into it and kills everybody.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, she was talked to by the ghost of her dead mother.
Yes.
Into killing those boys.
And she finds the remains of her uncle, too, who was murdered by her mother.
Yes. Yeah. Her uncle. And she gets talked to by her mother in that same sort of brick stairwell a number of times.
Oh, man. In the Samantha Fox cut, one thing that is just ridiculous is how many times they reuse the same footage over and over again. There's a lot of she's like backing down a hallway and then a guy's like coming up to get her with a knife. And then she's backing down the same hallway and then he's coming up to get her with a knife and she's backing down a hallway. And it's just the same shot looped two or three or four times. That happens two or three or four times.
To make the hallway look really long.
Or like the house look like it's five stories tall.
Oh God! When the blackout happened in either version, they're just lost in their own house.
Yeah,
yelling for each other.
I love how at the end of the Samantha Fox version, somehow the house turns into an apartment building.
Yeah. Oh my goodness!
Like just magically, she's running away. She runs up the upstairs to the second level, and all of a sudden, she's in an apartment stairwell.
Yeah,
an apartment stairwell.
Clothes just change from moment to moment, hairstyles change from moment to moment.
In the Samantha Fox cut, the guy who's playing her father is always, for some reason, is always unbuttoning or buttoning up his clothing.
That's true.
Yeah, like he's like he's like always doing up or taking off his shirt in every shot that he's in.
Just Mr. Buttons.
Yeah. Yeah. A scene happens at night, leave for outside and it's daytime. That Samantha Fox one is just like this fever dream. It's just kind of random images and mostly narration.
Yeah. It's like a whole bunch of random scenes and shots and stuff, like clumsily edited together, tied together by narration that sounds like the guy who used to narrate like books and records on tape.
See, and it's weird. I kind of enjoyed the narrator. I did.
He's a completely different narrator.
Completely different narrator.
Yeah, you got a different guy. The horror host. They were kind of doing like the Tales from the Crypt horror host in the in the Lost cut.
Yeah, in the Samantha Fox cut, there's an unnamed narrator who's just narrating the whole movie.
Well, no, he's a detective.
Three quarters of the way through the movie, you find out that he's a detective.
Well, no, they explain it right at the very beginning that he's the detective who was investigating these murders.
Oh, did they? I must have missed that.
Actually, no, they don't. It takes a little bit. It does take a little bit. Whatever she's putting together was last minute.
You know, with some of this stuff, if it was done with a shade more finesse, you could probably pass this off as a dream sequence. Like,
yeah,
it's a Jacob's Ladder type of deal where this is all happening in her head.
They
kind of do that in the Samantha Fox one.
Oh, okay.
Not well.
Kind of. Yeah.
Well, that's why I said finesse.
You know, there was a great scene in the Samantha Fox one where the detective is just detectiving. He's going around and then he's looking at her through the window. And then they say, oh, she wasn't used to having men look at her in that way. So she just starts to do a striptease for him through the window.
Oh.
Yeah, there was definitely
more. I love
more,
the word detecting.
There was definitely more sexploitation in the release cut. I mean, you got a porn star, you might as well use her, I guess.
That whole movie had me shaking my head, but also laughing.
You can't help but laugh because it's so terrible. It's so terrible.
Yeah, because otherwise you're going to scream or cry.
Every single time an axe came into contact with a person, it looked like they were being nudged with an axe and then their head would just flop off their torso.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Humans look extremely fragile in these movies.
For sure. Okay, I'm going to run the trailer here, such as it is, and we will come back and talk about more of A Night to Dismember from 1983.
You're perfectly safe here. Do I scare you? I'm going to take you on a journey. A journey of terror. As I describe a new movie. This movie will destroy the myths of all horror films. It will be an experience that will have its audience asking itself what has gone wrong in the world today. This film is called A Night to Dismember.
I hate them. I hate them. I wish they were dead.
The cellar of the grave to the attic of the haunted, A Night to Dismember will stun and startle even those with the strongest will, who have no belief in the supernatural. A Night to Dismember will electrify you with its special effects and camera work. Its moments of raw psychological terror will have you quaking in your seat.
That was a trailer for A Night to Dismember from 1983 with a story and screenplay by Judy J. Kushner and directed by Doris Wishman, starring a bunch of meat sacks you've never heard of before. The release cut was Samantha Fox in the lead as Vicky, and the lost version was Dee Cummins as Vicky. It's basically like friends and family members that are in this movie, because Diane Cummins is Dee's sister Mary. You've got Saul and Miriam Meth, which is great because there was a real life couple that were playing the parents. But yeah, you got William Zarka and John Zarka. William Zarka was Billy. You've not heard of anybody. There's like one guy who had a nice long career despite doing this movie. And a few of them, like Samantha Fox, are more famous for doing porn. Same with Larry Hunter. But Rob DeRosa was a character named Marty. And his last credit was in Maniac, the Netflix miniseries.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah, so he's been very active. But he's like the only one.
Yeah, he falls into line with that sort of trope that I found about the guy who plays the drunk guy in Dr. Renault's. He's like the creep, the homeless guy, the creep, the homeless guy. He's like, if you look at his credits, it's it's very much sort of the very same character type. So he does look fairly creepy, apparently.
You know, sometimes you have a niche and you just burrow in there. It's just what you have.
Yeah, lean right into it. Yeah.
Were you able to find, I was kind of trying to find it and I haven't had much luck, but do you know who the actor was who played the detective in the Samantha Fox version? Because his voice sounds so familiar. I feel like he was a narrator for stuff professionally.
I don't know, because if they gave him credit in the credits, they would have just gone by his name. And I don't think I ever caught his name other than detective, and he's not credited as detective. So I never was able to narrow down who that was.
And I also think that it was a different person playing the detective compared to the person who was doing the voiceover.
Oh, I guarantee it. If they were shooting all that stuff silently, they just were probably finding decent voices. I doubt anybody did their own voices.
Because there was at one point, there was somebody's getting off the phone, and it was this, it's a very young woman, but it sounded like a 60-year-old smoker. And I was like, oh, okay. That's who was answering the phone. I couldn't figure it out.
It's really, especially if you're watching the original cut, it's nearly impossible to follow what the hell is going on.
the audio is about 20 seconds behind.
Yeah. Well, and at least I was able to keep up with the lost version. Like, I knew what the plot was there. Narratively, at least it made sense to me for the most part. It certainly had its problems too. It wasn't nearly as hilarious as the release cut, but I'm kind of glad I got to see it, because you get to see the pieces. Like, it's basically like the release cut is this puzzle that's been jumbled together. You don't know what it looks like, and they've jammed the pieces together hoping to find something. And then you finally know what the puzzle looks like, and that's the lost version. So when you start seeing these individual pieces back in context, you're like, oh my God, that was her mom, not her sister. And like, it's a very different movie, but ultimately I think there's an interesting story here about mental health issues and how at least her family unit is letting her down and was very much complicit in both characters' mental breakdowns. And that could be where you work from. That's kind of your story there, although more recently the Joker did it really well, so I don't know if you'd need to do it again, but it could be fun. I mean, I think there is narratively an interesting story there that can be updated, but you kind of need to see the psychologists and things like that as we start seeing her world breaking down.
Yeah, and you know, personally, I don't think it's a terrible idea to have a story where in the Samantha Fox cut, they were kind of going for this thing where her sister and her brother, in one line of dialogue, they basically say that her sister was used to being doted on by her parents, and now that her sister is back, she thinks that her sister is going to get all the attention. So her and her brother make a plan to get her sister sent back to the asylum, and she's doing it by like murdering people and blaming it on her sister. But at the same time, there's a thing where she's getting her brother to dress up in costumes to try to scare her sister to make her think that she's crazy again.
Yeah. A lot of that was reshoots because her brother's dead within inside 10 minutes of the lost cut.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the most interesting thing, actually, to compare both of them, was how there was a lot of stuff at the end of the Samantha Fox version that happened at the beginning of the lost cut.
Yeah. She completely reorganize the footage for the released version. In the lost cut, there's the mysterious brother Sam, who it's like is at the beginning of the movie, and then he has like a brief moment sort of midway through the movie before Vicky's born. Why did you even have that character?
Right? Because you promised that he could be in a movie.
Yeah. He was probably just there, but was only there for a day. So
yeah.
It's either cut out his scenes that she needed or leave it in and hopefully nobody notices. That was kind of our, I think our credo is like, nobody will notice. Nobody will notice. We noticed.
Yeah.
But we did.
Lots of stuff can be noticed. Maybe that's the problem with doing so much sexploitation is you're so used to having an audience that's just busy jerking off that nobody will notice.
I love when Billy was sneaking into her bedroom, trying to scare her. She freaks the fuck out. Billy leaves and she just goes back to sleep.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh,
nobody does that.
I loved all of the death scenes in the Samantha Fox cut. Like they were so like ineptly shot, but over the top, but at the same time, weirdly effective at times. Like it was this weird mishmash of being like zero craft involved and actually some craft involved.
So it's so incompetent, it loops around to artistic.
Well, there is that one shot where like her dad, and it's in both cuts of the movie, but where he gets stabbed in the neck with that ice pick. Where, like, that's actually kind of a cool effect where they have the pick coming through the other side of his neck. And, like, that looked pretty good.
But she used it three more times in the release version.
Yeah.
Okay. Speaking of things coming out the other... when she attacks them in the car, reaches through the car seat, through her uncle's chest...
Yes!
...to push out his and squeeze his still beating heart. I don't like. She was just a human being.
That was hilarious. I forgot.
See what
about
bothered
that
me about that is he looked like he was obviously out of the car. Like the visual, of his head it in blood. Like, he's not in the vehicle.
No. The entire attack looks like it's happening in a room.
Yeah.
Rather than the vehicle.
Yes.
Yeah. I noticed that it's really noticeable in the lost version. Actually, it's a little better cut in the release cut, but it's still
surprisingly
insanity.
Yeah,
it's still insanity.
Well, I find myself in this really weird place where I feel like narratively and from a technical standpoint, the lost cut is better, but I like the Samantha Fox cut one more. I mean, it's more entertaining, but there's somehow more interesting story beats. I mean, yeah, it's strange. It's a completely ineptly made garbage fire of a movie, but it's really entertaining.
You know, you're right kind of there, Jeff, because with the lost version, it's a fairly linear story. You have your first act and a half, which is Mary's pregnancy and the illegitimate child and putting it up for adoption, and then there's Vicky's story. But at least with this mess of garbage fire, as you said, of the released version, there's at least some sort of twist happening. It's not a good twist, but it's almost like she put more thought into misdirection with this version that she ultimately released.
Yeah, I kind of like that she at least was trying, and I think maybe that's probably on Doris Wishman's tombstone is she tried. But, I mean, it was fairly obvious that Mary was the one doing the killing and that it was misdirection. Yeah. But it certainly was a little more interesting because it's a lot more linear in the lost cut. Half that movie is about her mom being a psycho and the other half is her being a psycho. There's no misdirection. There's no whodunit. And I kind of like that she tried to do that. And maybe we can have, like, I'm trying to figure out a way where we can merge both of these versions into one weird ass narrative.
Yeah.
Or you just embrace the awfulness and release it as a straight up comedy.
What you could have is a fraternal twin instead of just one baby, and fraternal twins are not identical, so you wouldn't know. And like that's her like best friend somehow growing up, or then you have a weird sister thing.
Like they were both both of them. I mean, obviously they're sisters. Both of them had a psycho mother. Like you could have a thing where you think it's misdirection. I mean, the girl who gets sent to the asylum, she could obviously have killed somebody, but it could just be a thing where they're, you know, they're both killers.
Actually,
and
I think we might
have a twist that way.
Yeah, I think we're onto something here. I like the idea of fraternal twins, me being one myself. That
no, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, I'm a twin. You didn't know that.
Explains a lot.
Does it? I want to know what the questions are now.
Yeah, me too.
I'm like, what does that explain?
And his brother.
Why is there sometimes a Village of the Damned feel when you're together?
They're most definitely. It's actually a very weird disconnect because they are so different.
Yes, that is true.
Like, so different. It's kind of neat.
Okay.
It's like you like subdivided the uterus and are like, fuck you. This is what I'm going to be.
So I kind of like the idea of the fraternal twins. Now, what if, like, we're talking about mental illness that maybe is already inherent in them, they're born with. And what if they're separated at birth? And I'd prefer if maybe they're even nearly identical. It'd be more fun. But they were separated at birth, once put up for adoption, and is going through the foster care system of a system that's failing her, while the other one is being raised in an abusive household, both with mental illness, both following the same path, and come together midway or near the end of the film, rediscovering each other and their mutual love for killing everybody else.
And they're fucking alibiing each other.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Like you can have it like do that sort of thing where it's like, oh yeah, twins know what the other twins are up to. And they just have that communication like, okay, alibi in place.
Yeah. Well, you'd have like the one saying out for dinner with her friends while her sister's killing. It's like, oh yeah, no, she was out for dinner with us.
Yes.
Play off that twins replacing each other kind of thing.
Ooh, I like that.
Especially you could do that and still have it where she's setting up her other sister. Like they're playing off of each other, but one of them or both of them thinks that they're going to get the upper hand because you can't maintain that forever. And they're like, she thinks that she's planning for it all to fall on her sister, but her sister is actually also doing the same thing.
It's a competition and see who can get them first. I want to kill my parents. No, I want to kill my parents.
Well, or you could have one of them who really is like wants to get better, quote unquote, and thinks if she kills her sister, the urge will go away. Or she sets up her sister. Like you could almost have one who does want to be, she knows what she's doing is wrong, but she can't help herself.
But you could also have the bit too. Yeah. She can't help herself, but it's sort of like, if there's just one of me, then this will go away.
Yeah. Because maybe she feels like the connection she has with this long lost twin is what's actually driving her to kill. It's that she's feeling her sister's urges and that's what makes her want to kill.
Yeah.
So
like
by
that.
Getting rid of her, she won't feel that urge anymore.
Nice.
I feel like that's a kind of a well-traveled trope of like twins who have a mind connection and are killers. But I really like the idea of a twin thinking that if they kill the other one, her urge to kill will go away. I don't know if I've seen that before.
I want to enter a caveat here right now. I have no magical powers nor any sociopathic tendencies to want to kill anybody. Just saying.
We know that.
I'm not talking to you specifically, Trish.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. Given the world the way it is.
There's thousands of people listening to us right now. Just wanted to clarify. No magical powers that you are aware of.
Well, yeah. There's some magic to you. We know this, but they don't. Sorry, I completely forgot where I was going because we went into a magical tangent. I was reading this story is kind of a creepy one, but it would kind of tie into this where there was these two twin sisters that were born and they kind of had their own language and they didn't talk to anybody else. And it's sort of until one of them died, the other one was never really verbal. And it was kind of like, we figured one of us had to die so one of us could have the life.
Yeah. I saw something about that recently.
Yeah. What was that?
I can't remember. It's a true story thing. But it's like super creepy. And I think it really ties into like this.
I think I saw that in a YouTube video or something.
Yeah. Well, I was looking up creepy stories because I was like, I just want some scares. And I stumbled across that.
Well, that could be interesting too. I mean, if we're not going to have them meet as sisters right away, or we can, but I kind of like the idea of both being on similar paths.
Yeah. I really like the idea of, it's like that idea where in the Lost cut, they're mad that she gets pregnant, but instead of giving them both up for adoption, like they could be like, oh, we're gonna raise your illegitimate kid, but then she has twins, so they give up one of them. Like I think that is a thing that does happen. I mean, that's a pretty good setup for a story like this. I think
we're on the right track. I think it gives it a little more to work with. I don't want to say more depth because, I mean, there's anything, anything's going to give this movie more depth. But yeah, it certainly gives us a little bit more to work with, and it fills it out and gives us something a little bit different that might be a little samey, but we can do something different with it.
Yeah.
Because I feel like also in a remake, this would be a movie where I feel like I would want to play on some of the stranger visuals that we got from the Samantha Fox cut, kind of the more weird, dreamy aspects to it, and see if you can work in some of that disjointed nature, but in a way where it's not like a cobbled together mess.
Yeah, well, if you're if you're visually representing some of their delusions of how they see the world in an artistic way, that could make for something. I mean, essentially, this is just a twist on tried and true slasher fare, so you want to make it a little more interesting somewhat. I mean, this isn't going to be like a theatrical release. It's probably going to be a direct to streaming somewhere kind of thing, or even a sci-fi movie of the week from the asylum, but at best. It could be directed by my neighbor next door, and it will still be better.
I feel like one thing I would like to try to combine from both cuts that you could do pretty easily is in the Lost cut, there's a thing about how, you know, she grows up and everybody's making fun of her and all of this other stuff. And in the Samantha Fox cut, you have her sister and brother trying to torment her and make fun of her. But one thing I would like to keep is the brother dressing up as like the monsters to try to make her think that she's crazy. Just because that one scene where she's like on the beach or whatever, and then like a zombie comes out of the water and starts chasing her through the woods. Like, that's pretty great.
I think it, like, if you're going to do something that cheesy, like that's 50s cheesy.
Yeah.
And if you're going to modernize it, you can't get away with it without maybe fueling the fire. You have her watch a zombie movie, or you talk about maybe a zombie outbreak happening somewhere, or just so the delusions are already working in the back of her mind if you're going to try something like that, because she's susceptible to...
That was her brother in a costume.
Yeah, but no, you know, I'm saying in our version, right? You can't just do it in a new version and get away with it without people rolling their eyes. you need something to build up to it.
You don't even need to do that heightened level, like a zombie coming out of the water, as far as I can tell. Like, if you really want to mess with somebody, it's like a face in the crowd. Like, you plant the idea that this is a killer that's coming after her, or like just a guy in a black jacket is dangerous, and then just have her brother show up at different areas. It's really easy to mess with somebody like that, and it also doesn't seem so cheesy.
Oh, sure. You know, you can pull straight from your town or city's headlines, like if there was a murder or something, and it's like, he's going to come for you next or whatever. Like, it'd be that simple. But yeah, you got to build up to it and set it up, and not just, you know, these are like teenagers to early 20s people, right? So if somebody came into my room wearing a scary mask, sure, I might get a jump, and then I'm going to hit it in the fucking face with whatever's closest to me. I'm going to beat the ever-loving shit out of whoever did that. So like that's the realistic thing, not just turning over and going back to sleep.
But if you've seen like something on the media that there's a killer who wears that mask that goes into your room, that's going to be really fucked up. Going to react differently.
Now, if you want to keep that scene as pure as possible, and you have like this mask killer in the news, and then the brother is wearing that mask to scare her, and then she kills his ass, which just drives her crazier because she just killed her brother.
Yeah.
Now we got something.
A little bit of slightly subtle misdirection or whatever, but yeah, masked killer. Her brother comes in wearing said mask, but the only reason he has that mask is because that's the mask that his sister was using to do the murders.
Can I go darker?
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay. So first off, he's not her brother. He can't be. By definition, he cannot be a brother because his sister gave birth to this illegitimate child. So he's her uncle. He is sexually abusing her, and he's her father.
Ew. Yeah.
Is that too dark?
Dark, well, but it I would mean, they, mess her
they,
up.
They never say who the father is. She just gets pregnant. And the whole time...
Yes, they do. It's Frankie.
Do they?
Yeah, it's Frankie, yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Because the whole time, like, when she's sitting on the porch talking to her brother in the Lost cut, and all throughout, even in the Samantha Fox cut, it's like, I feel like there's something going on between this brother and sister
And that's kind of why it went where I went the way I did. And of course, as we were talking, I'm seeing the obvious flaw in making calling her brother because he couldn't be. But if we'd sort of lean into that a little bit more, that sense that we got from the Lost version, then we could have something that really would sort of help contribute to the mental problems. Because she's being abused by her brother, uncle, brother, uncle, father, actually, technically. And then you have
that's
that,
a hyphenate that, you don't want.
No, I mean, you really don't.
A thing where she thinks that it's her older brother, but it actually is her father. But it's like the age difference is close enough that that could, you know, be a thing.
And she always wondered why she had that snaggle tooth.
you start dealing with genetics, and that can create some problems with the brain and development and stuff like that. So it makes sense. It actually adds some sense to what's happening to her and her sister. Yeah,
you know, I actually wonder, this brings up a good point just generally, and if somebody knows, I would love to know, if you're predisposed to have a mental illness like schizophrenia or something, which, you know, if you have someone in your family, there's a certain percentage chance that you're going to get it. You know, higher if you're male sometimes, higher if you're female sometimes. But if you're also inbred, does that raise your chances of said mental illness that you might already be getting anyway? I wonder if there's been any studies on that.
I would say, here's the thing with the brother-uncle. I would say that it's like the brother-uncle-father. If it's her uncle and her mother was mentally ill and her uncle was unstable, you kind of got a double trouble situation happening there. But yeah, like there's a certain amount of genetic predisposition that goes into it. I would say if you're trying to double up, it's not good.
Yeah.
But well, the whole point of and inbreeding, it causes a genetic breakdown, right? That's why you need that fresh DNA infusion to keep that from happening. So yeah, I don't see why not. I mean, we're not scientists. We'll run this caveat right now for anybody who might be just yelling into their AirPods or whatever. We are not scientists. Accurate. We are fucking podcasters.
These are best guests at best.
We are making movie guesses because we're trying to think like filmmakers, and sometimes filmmakers think everybody else is dumb. And in this case, we think we're dumb, so we're going to come up with a dumb thing. That's just the way it is.
It will still be on screen if it's done right.
There's 10,000 movies where the science doesn't add up. It's fine.
So now that we've run that caveat, like admitting we're stupid, but we're going to make it sound like we're smart. And we want it to look like we're really smart on screen. As long as you buy it as a viewer, that's fine. If there's 1% of people going, that can't happen, that is far less than everybody who watched this movie in its
purest
form.
Like all those killjoys who are like, DNA doesn't work that way in Jurassic Park. You can't splice frog DNA to create a dinosaur. Like, yeah, it's less fun, though.
Yeah. Well, and here's the thing, too. The intelligence of this movie is not going to be about the science of it. It's whether it will scare you.
Yeah.
That's the whole idea.
A horror movie.
Yep.
Not need logic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And with Doris Wichman, is it titillating as well?
Oh, yes. And it wasn't. Even though there was some stuff that was clearly intended to be titillating, it was actually mildly disturbing, to be honest with you. Especially the really extended bathroom scene in the Lost version.
Yeah
It's like she's standing there fondling her breasts in the mirror. It's like, they were very nice breasts, don't get me wrong, but what purpose did it serve aside from padding the film out?
And also, as a possessor of boobs, never washed them like that.
Just saying
That's just something to spread knowledge to our audience.
Hey, but you know, maybe she was just really feeling herself, literally and figuratively.
And sorry, I love how she took one sock off, stopped, posed, fondled her breasts, and then just sort of stood there with like one sock on and one sock off. I don't know anybody who would like stop after taking off one sock.
Yeah.
Because it's a very strange feeling.
She's admiring her foot.
Yeah.
She's really proud of that one. But not the other one.
Yeah. You noticed how characters who were acting scared were more scared at her snarling than when she's dropping an axe on their head?
Yes.
Because she's not scary when she's hearing the axe. She looks like a 2-year-old carrying a tool over to their dad. It's very awkward, very scary in the sense that they don't have a firm hold of it, which means that if they hit anything or bump anything with it, it's falling. And the biggest risk to you is going to be that it falls and lands on your toes.
Yes.
And sure. in the released version, there's Samantha Fox holds it at the head of the axe when she's hacking at the detective.
Yeah.
I mean, that wouldn't even break the shirt, let alone his skin.
I think that might have just been a safety issue. She was like, it's the only way I can't do it.
I have a feeling they actually had a real axe and didn't have a fake one. Yeah. So yeah, they had to be very careful.
Yeah. Yeah, but there are ways to blunt a real axe so that it doesn't actually hurt any, like it doesn't actually break skin if it does accidentally make contact. There's some laziness there that, so they forsook realism for safety and it's very, very telling.
Oh yeah, no, it doesn't look like there's any real effort into her stabbing and axing motions at all.
No, and like anytime that Samantha Fox was holding a weapon, it looked incredibly awkward because there was a scene there where she was supposedly holding a knife. Like it looked like she'd never held a knife before, like, even to cook. Like it's like, I don't know what I'm doing with this sharp object.
I can't say Dee Cummins was any better.
No, they were both awkward as hell. And like I said, it's like, how do you get to that age without ever handling a knife? Because it actually looked more dangerous for them because of the way they're handling it than it did for whoever they were about to murder.
Yeah. You have to sometimes maybe send your actors to cooking class just so that they can get a feel for a knife.
Something. Or the director needs to go to cooking school and say, no, that doesn't look right. And I brought this up to Jay yesterday while we were chatting, and I have to point it out. Did anybody else notice how whenever somebody was running away, they put their back to the wall and moved as slowly as possible?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, I was about to say.
Yeah, I'm there's sorry. No running away. It's like, okay, let's create this sort of dramatic effect and they're looking behind them and stuff like that, but it just looks awkward.
Yeah, we're trying to get away. Who put this wall here? I can't get away now. I can run right or left, but I want to go the other way. I want to go the opposite of where I'm facing. And I can't do that because there's a wall there.
There's no other direction.
There's no other possible direction to get away.
Just slowly inch yourself down the longest hallway in the world.
Yeah.
There was There's one thing I'd like to keep for just humor reasons.
The smoky stairs?
The smoky stair. But the one other thing is too, is like, there's one kill she does with the one, I can't remember who it was, and she's against the wall. She's just kind of writhing side to side against the door and just screaming.
Yeah,
just
she looked like she was so really hilarious. I thought she was enjoying herself.
And running and just screaming. And I want to keep that somewhere.
You know, in the scene after she punches the guy's heart out in the car, when the woman is running away from the car and the Samantha Fox cut, all of the screaming, distressed noises that they use, didn't those just sound like porn clips, but like one on top of another?
Yes.
that was ridiculous.
Well, yes, because she borrowed stuff from her previous films to put it all together, right? So obviously she borrowed the audio file and tried to create a new sound and make it sound like somebody was scared, but it just sounded like porn films.
Including the music.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Yes.
Have you ever been watching?
You know what?
And the music is just as haphazard as the rest of the movie.
Yeah, Trish, in the Samantha Fox cut, the music is, it is like just generic 70s, like upbeat, happy sounding porn music throughout most of it.
Yeah, sometimes during a murder scene. And other times it's like this, some squelching noise. Like it's in the weirdest places.
Weird. So very weird.
So bizarre.
But you know what's funny? This movie made me think as well. Sometimes, haven't you been like at a place and like maybe you might have to watch, you have to watch this for the podcast, a horror movie, and the sounds do sound like porn sounds and you kind of just feel the urge to yell, I'm watching a horror movie, just so everybody knows this is killing sounds. Not porn sounds.
I have had to explain that to my wife, yes. I have actually had to have that conversation with my wife. I love when she comes down and I'm partway into a movie and she goes, what the fuck are you watching?
Did that happen this time?
It did. And she laughed because she saw what I was suffering through and she found it highly entertaining at how bad it was. So there's a win there, I guess, is she actually, instead of thinking I was broken somehow, she's like, oh, you poor person.
The things
it's
I make
okay,
you do
honey,
for
I'm
the
here
show.
For you.
Well, I, to be fair, I did have some part of in the decision making for this one. So I have only myself to blame.
Yeah,
for
I bounced a few options off of Sam. I was like, ooh, that sounds interesting. Ooh, yeah. What a fascinating backstory.
I did tell you, I gave you some suggestions and I eliminated this one because I didn't want to.
Oh, I'm really glad that we watched these movies. Like, they're massively fun, especially the Samantha Fox one. Yeah, completely inept, but in a very watchable way.
I can't believe you like the Samantha Fox one more.
Oh, you know, I would say that in terms of movies that are really terrible and are almost unwatchably bad, this is probably the best, the most watchable, unwatchable horror movie I've ever seen.
Yeah, it actually gets a 3.3 on IMDb. Very generous, by the way.
Very generous. I was expecting negative numbers after watching it.
Can't even do that, but it could miraculously happen.
Yes. And I
was thinking 1.5.
But I just want to point out that Jeff is exactly the person that we were talking about, this is how this becomes a cult film. I certainly don't feel the way Jeff does about it. I think it's fucking horrible and I'm never watching it again. But I can actually see Jeff getting his friends together when we're allowed to, with some drinks and having a blast with this.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and you know what? I think the eyes that I cast on this would have been brightened at least 10 times had I been able to watch this with you guys.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, certainly watching it with friends would make it a lot more entertaining, because then you can hack on it together and you create your own entertainment out of something that's not that great or is absolutely terrible. But we didn't have that option. And yeah, it did make it a much rougher watch.
Yeah.
Yeah. For somebody who's made 60 movies, you figure she would have been a lot better at it by this point in her career.
Again, it's for content, for jerking off, and not for doing a movie.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, budget matters too, right? I mean, the thing about that was appealing about horror, especially in the 70s, is you had Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and the same year, or just the year before, you had Halloween come out, and they were done on shoestring budgets, right? So it's you can see somebody who like Doris, who's an experienced filmmaker, maybe not a great filmmaker, but she's got some experience. And she's like, oh, I might be able to sort of dig into this niche and do something.
Yeah, that's probably exactly what she was thinking. You know, she was make stuff on the cheap that she could make money on. And horror was wide open for that at the time. It's a shame she came out so late. There was far too much competition by the time this movie actually had come out. I doubt it would have done any better in 77, but there wasn't a ton of competition at that point, and it wouldn't have felt wholly out of place next to Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Well, no,
at least the way it looks.
You could have bound it in with other, like, kind of a grindhouse double feature. It would have worked there.
Yeah, this is totally, totally grindhouse. Absolutely. Yeah.
I have a question for our version. How do we feel about a narrator?
You know what? Not only would I love a narrator, I would want my narrator to be John Waters.
Ooh.
I could get behind that. I mean, I wasn't thinking of a narrator, but if we're having a narrator, I would go with John as well. I would totally support that 100%.
If you're going to have a talking meat puppet, John Waters is the person I would endorse.
Because I was John thinking, Waters, and I haven't cast a narrator, so I thought, I'm going to ask about the narrator.
Yeah.
But he's like a big fan of Doris Wishman. He was in one of her last movies. Mm-hmm. He has a great voice for narration. If he was to be in it, you could kind of lean a little bit into like the sleaze trash angle, especially with the name recognition. That would guarantee that if this was a decently budgeted movie, it would make its money back.
Yeah. Oh, I definitely lean into the sleaze trash in my version.
Oh, yeah.
Let us get to casting. I think we need to get to casting.
Yeah.
So if anybody bothered, that was my plight. I'm like, fucking anybody.
Yeah. I actually did say to you, I almost didn't. I almost like, you know what? Fuck it. It could be literally anybody. And this cast is such a mess. It's so hard to tell who's who. Like, half the time it's like, okay, who was that? In both movies.
Yeah. I had trouble. So like finding names, there's like mom and dad. That's all I could think of.
No, I eventually kind of gave up on my casting, but I did come up with quite a few names. So let's fire off some names at random and see what happens.
Let's see what we get.
Jeff, what do you got?
So, as I already mentioned, I would love John Waters to be a narrator of some kind. And you know what? This is a movie where while I was watching it, my only angle is like, who could you cast in this movie who like wouldn't have a high price tag, but is like controversial enough that they could maybe be a draw? I don't know, like Lindsay Lohan.
But we want to get this movie done.
Oh, I mean, Lindsay Lohan is in stuff occasionally.
No, but I mean, like, consistently showing up to set is something we kind of want. I don't think our insurance will cover us.
It took Doors from 77 to 83 to get this fucking movie out. I think even with a trashy drunk, you're going to get out faster than that.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like one of those things where it's like, you know what? I don't have a lot of people specifically in mind, but stunt casting all the way.
Oh, I totally stunt casted. Totally stunt casted.
I did backflips with my casting.
I feel a good director. Actually, when I thought of this, I was like, I don't know if there could be another director, but I feel like Anna Biller should be the person who directs it, who did the love.
Who I did.
But she also did a movie called Viva, I believe.
Yep, that's the one.
She also did a movie called Viva, which was like kind of all about sexploitation. And it was kind of like maybe a bit of a homage to the types of movies that Doris Wishman originally made. I was watching, I've loved The Love Witch for years, but Joe Bob Briggs just did it for his Halloween thing. And we were watching that. He did an interview with
Anna Biller. Valentine's Day thing. It's Valentine's.
Yeah, it was really, really good. Yeah. But Anna Biller was saying that she's like writing another horror movie that's more of a slasher currently. So yeah, I feel like I can't think of another person who'd be more suited to make something like that could be a remake.
And she really likes to work in periods, so that would also add a lot of flavor to it. I think that's why Love Witch works.
Also because there's so many moments in this where it sort of like descends into just visuals and becomes kind of a tone poem.
Totally.
And I want that aspect to be kept. And I think Anna Biller can do that.
Yeah, exactly. As soon as I thought about it, the more I was like, I don't even know how you could find someone who's more suited to this. Yes, especially because I would also want it to be directed by a woman, just because, you know, Doris Wishman was a really prolific female director. Just in general, like, she was in her 40s. She was 46. And then her husband died. So she just decided that she was going to get into movie making. And
because she was bored,
she taught herself. Yeah, she was bored. She wanted to distract herself. So she taught herself every position that you could want to fill as a production person for a movie, like cinematography, directing, editing. Like, she was a one-woman show breaking into not only a male-driven medium, but a male-interest, male-driven medium.
Oh, well, thanks, Jeff, because that just ties in perfectly to my announcement to you guys.
Oh, really?
I'm about that age. No. But yeah, I'm exactly that age. So I could do that. Let's do that. I'm going to do that. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. And she made, well, like Jay said, she took a break after this movie, but she made a couple more movies before she died. And her last movie she made when she was like in her early 90s.
Nice.
No, I have a lot of respect for her. She sounds like a really fascinating woman. And you mentioned Joe Bob Briggs, who is a big fan of Doris.
Yeah. Like, he said that she was like the queen of trash cinema or something like that.
Queen is exploitation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. I saw her on her last interview, which was on Conan O'Brien. And she comes out and she's sitting next to film critic Roger Ebert. And asked Robert, what did you think of my movie? Robert's like, well, I usually like to watch them before I review them. That was him just trying to dance around it. Meanwhile, Conan's like, let's run a clip. And she's just a feisty old lady too.
Nice.
Ready for a fight. Then Conan comes back from the clip. So the woman that's sunbathing, that was shot in 77, right? In the 70s, yes? It's like, that's correct. And the other stuff was new footage? That's right. I've never seen a movie shot that way, says Conan. And she's like, well, what's wrong with it? Nothing. not wanting to fight this lady.
As you mentioned, like, reusing footage, I think his name is Godfrey Ho, I think. And he's a filmmaker who's basically like just filmed a whole ton of stuff over the years. And like a bunch of his movies are just like recuts of a bunch of stuff he's already filmed. Like, he's just made several movies out of the same footage, mostly.
Wow.
Well, she did it.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm like, yeah, if we're going to mention that, we got to mention Godfrey Ho. Like, there's something really, an auteur, there's something very fascinating about doing that. I mean, not to waste anything.
Yeah, and she certainly doesn't. And yeah, it sounds like Godfrey didn't either. Maybe even he planned it that way. That was sort of his artistic vision all along, was like, I'll just film a whole bunch of stuff and use it to piece together other films.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's continue on with the casting. Jeff, did you have anything else to add to yours?
No, other, yeah, I mean, this is not one I... It's like basically you could cast any person, like you said, any meatbag could be in this movie.
Yeah.
And it would probably work.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
not a movie that's just, about the actors. That's why I just go stunt cast.
Yeah, grab some drywall guy off the street. You know, like, you'll be good.
Just like cast people where people would be like, oh, like that person's in this movie. Like that sounds crazy, but for no reason really other than they're...
Hey, you know, brow, can you drive a car? Can you act scared at a girl is snarling at you? Perfect.
Oh, yeah. By the way, that shot that's at the end of both movies where she's walking down the street and then the guy pulls up in the truck and he's like, hey, you need a ride? And then she just like makes a weird, fierce face at him. And then he he just looks scared and drives away. It's like the best scene in both movies.
Well, you know, creepy unibrow, it'll set you off.
And there's that one
shot. He should be lucky. He lived.
Yeah, he did. There's that one shot where she's having, I think it's the dream where she has the blood all over her face. That's actually probably the best actually like framed and shot in the film. Like because it's one of those ones that you see even now, you see that particular shot sometimes in relation to horror films. And I mean, it's completely out of place in this film because it does look really good. Even the film stock seems to be better.
Hey, at least at some point in the movie, she has blood on her. No other time does she. She has to dream about the blood, murdering lots of people and not getting anything on you. That's her fucking superpower.
Well, the dream sequence I kind of liked too, with like sort of that photo negative type of deal where they have the axes. And I like that weird visual because it does feel disjointed and like a dream.
And that informed my director. I'll tell you who it is when I get to it. But that kind of informed some of my choices in terms of casting too.
Cool.
Just that scene.
All right. Well, Trish, why don't you carry on with your casting?
All right. So I did cast like the original, like Mary Kent, the one who's pregnant, because I just had this actress in my head, Julia Garner, because I wanted to put this in our movie. I wanted to be in the 70s and then we push it forward to now, but because she's, or push it forward to the 90s, because she seems to me to be a very 70s looking actress. Like, I don't know why. It seems like she's not of this time frame. So I quite like her in like period stuff. For her mom, I went with Chloe Sevigny. Her dad, Sam Rockwell. And I actually cast Frank, who is Cody Fearn from American Horror Story. And then Billy was Finn Wittrock from American Horror Story. But I can't remember if he's old. This is the other thing about casting. I couldn't remember if Billy was like old timeline or new timeline. So I put him there.
Doesn't matter. We're going with our timeline. So
exactly.
Yeah, already your casting is way too good for this movie.
I know, but I want to make a good movie.
Yes. You do.
So for Vicky, I went with Tessa Farmiga because I just think it would be funny to watch her kill a bunch of people. Like, I mean, I like American Horror Story, a lot of stuff happened, but I just want to see her get covered in blood a few times. I think she just needs that. And then her mom, Gillian Anderson, because I think it would just be like her foster mom, Gillian Anderson. I think I want this fascination where it's like her foster mom, it's slightly antagonistic, but like there's an undercurrent of fear between the two of them. Like, her mom is afraid of her and she's afraid of her mom. And I feel that those two can really play it. And Gillian Anderson's awesome.
Yeah, she's like actually a really good actress.
Absolutely. And then for the dad, John Carroll Lynch, who's also an American Horror Story, because he's just, but I want him to be sort of, he's trying to understand. I wanted to make him more sympathetic, where he's kind of trying to understand Vicky, but he's still kind of, he doesn't know what's going on and he's still kind of afraid. And then that's all I cast. And I just had my director, Anna Biller.
Nice. All right, Sam.
Okay, so yeah, I knew you were going to save yourself for last because, well, I know what you did.
Last summer.
No, cold winter.
Ah.
Yes. So I kind of cast as though you were actually wanted to make a good movie as well.
Nice.
So I cast Vicky and Mary Kent. I cast actual sisters. I cast Elle Fanning and Dakota Fanning.
Nice.
Oh, good one. That plays really well for what we were planning.
Exactly. It worked out really well.
And they're a good age for it, too.
They are a very good age for it. And that's, again, that all informed my casting for them. For the mother and father, I cast Keira Sedgwick and Nicolas Cage.
Nice.
For brother Billy, I cast Patrick Schwarzenegger.
Good.
I also cast the aunt and uncle. And that, again, works really well with what we've sort of come up with. They can be like the foster parents instead if we need them to be. I cast Judge Reinhold and Jennifer Jason Leigh.
I love what you're doing here because you're kind of embracing the overtopness of that this could be.
Yes,
exactly.
You were probably thinking like mom and dad type of.
I, that kind of led me into it, and that's why I didn't do Selma Blair, because I'm like, I don't want to go too far into Mom and Dad. But definitely,
but you're
a
going
bit
for
of that.
That flavor. Yeah.
That,
exactly. So I actually had two directors, because I kind of wanted, one part of me wanted to really lean into the sleaze and the blood. And that had me thinking, I'd love to see Peter Jackson, we've done this before, go back to that sort of early stuff, like The Brain Dead and stuff like that, where he just really leans into just the gore. And I thought he'd have a lot of fun with something like this. But my chosen director is the woman who directed The Strange Color of Your Body's Tears. And I go to this a fair bit, but this is the first time I've actually used her as a director, I think. Her name is Helene Cattet. And she does some really, really beautiful visual stuff in this great use of color. And that sort of like that hallucination dream suite sequence you were talking about, just sort of made me think of her and think how neat.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
Yeah, it is. It's such a really interesting watch.
I haven't seen that one yet, but Let the Corpses Stand was another one of hers, and really good movie. So.
Yeah. So yeah, she's incredibly talented. And like Jeff said, I did want to go with a female director, given that it is Women in Horror Month and that's what we're celebrating here. Let's embrace that a little bit and go with somebody who I know can make a really beautiful and interesting film.
Nice. Awesome. I, however, did not want to do that.
I actually have thought of three casting choices that I think would be really good.
Okay. I'll let you add to yours before I get to mine.
Yes. Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen.
I thought about that, but I thought they might have been too old to do this.
They're retired. They made too much damn money as child stars.
Well, they're in their 30s, aren't they?
Yeah. That's okay, I mean, but they look young, especially if
they would be great stunt cast. Like, could you imagine if Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen were in a movie like this? Like, people would see it out of curiosity.
Oh, yeah. That's really good stunt casting.
And
I think
they'd
like to go edgy.
Yeah. And for Billy, Macaulay Culkin. There you go.
Nice. He would look like a sibling to them.
That would definitely draw people out of curiosity's sake. Okay, well, it's funny when you said John Waters for the narrator, I actually wrote him down as my director / crypt keeper. So going against the grain of actually having a male be the director of this movie, but being the big fan of Doris Wishman that he was, I'm like, why not? Why not? He could be our crypt keeper, narrator dude, and be my director. And keeping with Doris Wishman's sleaze and working with porn stars, so did I. My entire cast are porn stars, majority of which have done mainstream films. Only a couple haven't because I had to fill it out and I only know so many porn stars that have crossed over, so which wasn't many. So for Mary Kent, I went with Sasha Gray. For Vicky, just because I think she could do crazy really well, Anya Olsen. For Billy Kent, the brother, I went with Tyler Nixon. For Ann Todd, I went with Nina Hartley. For her husband, I went with Paul Thomas. For Blanche Kent, I went with Tracy Lords. And for Adam Kent, I went with Tommy Gunn.
I only knew about half those names.
I'm surprised he didn't have James Dean in there.
Yeah, he's been in too much trouble lately.
He doesn't seem like it.
He's a little too much controversy for me to throw in my casting.
I'm surprised. Wait, did you have Evan Strahm in there?
Nope. Well, I mean, there's lots of other roles to do. I just stuck with the families, the two families. So that was good enough.
Yeah.
But well, Evan funny. Strahm would be a good one.
Because you know what? Here's the thing. The Pirates Porn movie that had like a regular release, he's actually funny and quite entertaining in that.
Yeah. No, there's actually some very good actors in porn. And if that's where I was thinking, I'm like, have I seen a porn where the dialogue was actually pretty good? And that's who I would lean towards.
Nice.
I think Pirates was one of the very few porn movies where it had like a separate DVD release of like without the sex scenes, because it's like actually pretty good.
You could rent it at Roger's Video. I remember because I rented it and being like, wait, is this porn? And that's when I found out.
Oh, boy.
And then, I honestly didn't know. I rented it completely innocently. And then I was like, oh, so then I went to go get the porn. Because you gotta.
Happy Valentine's Day, everyone.
By the time they hear it, it's like end of February. What are they talking about? Yeah. That was 2 weeks ago.
Hey. Self-love is still love.
Well, I got to tell you, the research into my actors was arduous.
I'm sure it was, Jay. I'm sure it was. I'm sure your right wrist is killing you.
I just
only
to
doing
the left.
It. Only doing it in like short, few minute sections at a time with breaks and water.
And showers.
You must hydrate when you're casting, especially that kind of stunt casting. You got to hydrate a lot. It's very important.
It's important to stay hydrated. That's really right.
Yeah.
In general.
It's always a good tip.
Yeah. That's what we're talking about.
Sometimes the tip is eight inches away, but. And that's why I went with that kind of stunt casting, because it's good comedy.
Well, this is one of the few movies where, you know, going into that kind of tangent completely makes sense in line with what we're talking about.
And the director's career and all of that.
It's very topical.
I honestly had no idea how to cast it, that it popped into my head. I'm like, she cast a porn star, multiple porn stars. So am I. I'm going to cast porn stars. I've never done that before.
That's inspired. You should be proud.
I was. This is like my second favorite casting next to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
And because you just got to go nuts.
Oh, yeah. That was insane, because I did a whole plot with that one.
Nice. Well, and it would be fun to lean into the camp, because, you know, I think sometimes like the porn stars, they're like, okay, so this is a job. I don't have to screw anybody. And I get to have fun with it. Holy shit, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I'm like, you know, they would have a blast doing
Give them a chance. Give them a blast. Yeah. And like, maybe show other people what they can do.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen successful crossovers before. Mm-hmm. So Sasha Grey's still struggling with that, but she's getting work. And Jenna Jameson's had quite a few.
Would You Rather is actually a really decent horror movie that Sasha Grey is in.
It's okay.
It's fun. I mean, Jeffrey Combs, it's hard to go wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Jeffrey Combs is pretty good.
Who was the most famous one who came out?
Tracy Lords.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Unquestionably, it was the most probably the most famous and to sort of make that transition.
Definitely a slow build for her, too. But I think Blade was the breakout movie for her. And then after Blade, people didn't think of her as a porn star anymore.
No.
Yeah.
And she has a pedigree with John Waters as well. So
yes, she does.
That worked out really well.
She was in Crybaby, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was in Crybaby. I think she was in one of its other films as well.
Yeah. So I think everybody had some great casting. Some were way better than this movie deserves, and I would still watch them based on our plots. And,
because,
like
the director of this movie, I'm feeling the aspirational aspects of what could be done.
Yes.
Just feeling the need to create something.
Yeah. Doris Wishman, she did stuff throughout her career, and I'm sure she's still making films on the other side right now because she wants to.
Nice.
Yeah, you get the feeling that she did love making movies.
Mm-hmm.
Good or bad, she seems to have really loved doing it. I think that's the most important thing about it is, you know what, go ahead, do it. It can be bad, it can be good, but just do it.
You don't have to like what she produced, as long as you're inspired by it and you can go do your own thing. Now we're seeing lots of women starting to break out in the last few years, and especially in horror. So if you've got a good idea, pursue it. And you never know what's going to be on the other side of it. I mean, I've been through film school, but there's plenty of people who are working in this industry who've never gone to film school. And you just need
to... And they're quite successful.
Yeah, you just need to work with people who know what they're doing, and you'll learn along the way. And,
Listen and surround yourself with the best people. But you know, when you talk about like the joy of just making films, like, do you remember when there's that friend who had money and had like a video camera, and the first time you went over to play and they had the video cam and you're like, we gotta do something with this. And
it's funny you mentioned that, so Trish, because when I was in like theater in high school, one of our assignments was to like take one of those big old lunky VHS cameras and make a film. So we made a horror film, right?
Nice.
And I was watching it, and I'm going, good Lord, my 7-minute horror film was better than the original release of this film. Like, because in terms of like gore and effects, there's this one great scene where we dropped a rock on somebody's head, and the way we cut it, it actually, because the way it actually is my head that they dropped it on, but the way they dropped it is the way I moved. It actually looked like they dropped it on my head.
Ooh.
Because they were sort of focused on my torso so that when the rock dropped, it wasn't actually on my head. But as I moved out of the way, it looked like I twitched like somebody had actually dropped something. It looked fucking amazing. And I wonder where that is.
Oh, if it ever gets found. Oh, to watch it would be amazing.
We'll have to drop it on our YouTube channel.
If anybody out there who is actually listening of the seven people who might have seen it in the or had a copy, please let me know and share it with me because I would love to get my hands on it because it was fun. I mean, it's definitely not good. Don't get me wrong. It is not good. Oh. But there are moments there that are like, that worked really well.
Yeah. I wish I still had, I don't know if it ever got lost, but what we did in one of my classes was we had to do a music video to a song and I did Parents Just Don't Understand. It's not great. I dressed up doing the Will Smith parts, but there's a point where like driving off in the car and I borrowed my friend's car, put a Ken and a Barbie in it and had it running across the floor.
Nice.
It was so much fun just to do it and create it and then cut it together with the two VHS tapes.
Yeah.
Remember that whole method?
That's a lost art.
That was so much fun.
Kids these days.
Yeah.
They don't know about cutting together movies with VHSs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Sam.
They have all the editing on their phones.
That's right. Well, Sam, I heard the Women in Horror website is shutting down after this month. Yeah, this will be the last official Women in Horror, but that's certainly not going to stop us, is it?
Not by any means. With all the horror, we're definitely going to be continuing our support of Women in Horror, whether that be an annual event or just ongoing support for Women in Horror. And I know that we'll do that through the podcast as well.
Yes, absolutely. We're going to always support female filmmakers and including horror, but we're not going to limit ourselves to that genre. But I think we'll always in February at least drop an episode saluting women in horror as we've done the last few years. So
yeah,
we're going to continue it. Watch for the hashtag WIHM.
Yeah.
And we'll keep doing it.
Could I make a small request? Maybe. Can we do it around Valentine's Day? Because my usual Valentine's Day is drinking and watching horror movies. So this really kind of just goes with it.
It fits in really nicely. Well,
if the timing works out, then yes.
It's a love letter to women in horror. So I think it's a good time, like just around that time frame.
Yes. I like that they gave us a heart in hand in this movie. Mm-hmm. It just felt like Valentine's Day after that.
Yeah, I do want to sort of explain why Women in Horror is shutting down. It's not because they're tired of doing it or they don't want to do it anymore. They just don't feel it's necessary anymore because Women in Horror is the message is out there and women are being recognized in horror daily and openly and they're getting the support that they were looking for when they started the event. And I think that that's commendable that's a small event.
But it doesn't mean it doesn't mean you should stop.
No,
absolutely.
Watching and stop saluting these women who are starting to break boundaries that were used to be inherent in the industry of a male-driven industry. It's not that way anymore, and it never should have been because everybody can make a movie if you've got the time and patience.
Even with this movie we're talking about today, Doris Wishman for a long time was the most prolific female director, mm-hmm. period. And she for a very long time was one of the only women who got regular work as a director. And we've really, really come a long way since then.
Yeah. I mean, she went out there and made the work for herself to a certain extent. And that's part of what made her as successful as she was because she didn't wait for somebody to hand it to her. She just went, says, you know what, I'm doing this and get out of my way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is that to like a certain respect as well. Like you have to do that, but then it's like the release thing is usually where a lot of people would fall down.
Yeah, I also think she's, well, now we got lots of methods. You could release straight to YouTube now.
Right?
But there's lots of methods. I mean, that speaks to her go get it done mm-hmm. attitude. But I'm pretty sure she was a bit of a shyster too to get things done. We've alluded to and alleged that maybe there's some shenanigans to get this movie made. We'll never know the full story. And that is part of the fascination of A Night to Dismember is the background story is just as fascinating, if not more fascinating than the film itself. It's definitely, let's not mix words. It's definitely more fascinating than the movie itself.
It genuinely is.
Yeah. All right. Well, if you want us to, well, I don't want to do any more movies like this, but if you have a request that is, that you would like us to do either a comparison or a challenge, a fan challenge, you can let us know on our social media at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion of the Remake on Facebook and Instagram, and Invasion of the Remake at gmail.com, where you can send us your suggestions, your corrections, your comments, or you can just chat with us. That's cool too. We love hearing from you, and you can do it in all of those wonderful places. In fact, I had one just come in earlier this week. So always be patient. We'll get to them when we get to them. We always have our own stuff planned as well. So could be months before we actually get to somebody's suggestion, and we don't particularly do them in order. It's more of a when we feel like where it fits in naturally. So yeah, just watch for it. Listen for your name to come up when you're on your episode. And hopefully it's something that we want to do as well. We'll let you know ahead of time if it's not going to make the show. So there are no wrong suggestions, but some are not going to be full episodes. They just won't be right for the show. If you want a better chance, though, let us know where to watch it or how to watch it. And make sure it's before the year 2000. I won't even consider remaking something after the year 2000. You know, shitty movie was out 2 years ago. I don't want to kick it down while the wounds are still fresh.
Plus, we're older, so the 90s just happened.
Yeah, for everybody who says back in that 90s was a long time ago. It isn't for us, okay? Yeah.
Those were your golden years.
Like, yes, you're 20. You haven't experienced anything yet. But yeah, so let us know on our social media and let everybody else know about the show. Pass it on. Tell them how much you're enjoying it and tell them where to find us. If you haven't already pointed out on a device or a podcast provider, you can find it on a central hub. Sam, what's the website?
It is invasionoftheremake.wixsite.com/podcast.
And by going there, you can help get more
earballs
on the show. There's also a tab there that says store. Yeah, we have merch, guys. We have merch. We might even have merch for this movie. Not yet, but it might be coming because I'm sure our brains are reeling with merchandise ideas for this one.
Yes.
So hit the store button and that'll take you to our TeePublic store. And we've got lots of cool designs there and designs from other people as well, of designs we appreciate. And from every sale, we get a little cut and that goes back into the production of the show. And you can wear something really cool on your chest or your face, or drink out of it, or post it on your wall, or make it a tote bag. There's lots of cool stuff and cool ways to enjoy what we've got there. So go check it out. Angry Fish is waiting for you.
Yes.
Don't delay.
Angry Fish needs your help.
Yeah. So go click on that store tab and get yourself some sweet, sweet, sweet Invasion merch. Next week, we've go back to our comparisons, and we're going to go travel across the world for this one. Until then, I've been Jason.
I'm always Sam.
I continue to be Trish.
And I always return as Jeff Omega.
And we are out of here.
As Vicky goes off in the night.